and some other surprises with Patrick Henry Bass, but we begin today with the Supreme Court. The court will hear arguments on two cases this week that will consider civil rights. Today's case considers a young woman suing her Arizona school district for strip searching her after she was suspected of having prescription-strength ibuprofen. The other will be heard tomorrow, brought by white firefighters and one Latino from New Haven. It's all about affirmative action. Here to discuss the Supreme Court cases and also what looks like a sort of tantalizing theme in the Justice Department under Eric Holder's approach to the court is Kenji Yoshino. He's the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Law at NYU Law School. He's right here in the Takeaway studio. Kenji, thanks for coming back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me again, John.
You know, let's talk about the specific facts of these two cases, and then I think the theme and the strategy and the sort of delicate relationship between the Justice Department and the court, at least in the glimpses that we have so far, is a pretty interesting discussion. First of all, the case that's going to be heard today.
Yes, that case is Safford versus Redding, and that's a case, as you said, where a 13-year-old girl was strip searched for having ibuprofen in middle school. So it's a classic Fourth Amendment search and seizure case, and the standard is generally reasonable suspicion. So what I find really interesting about this is that, on the one hand, you know, this just seems like a complete outrage. On the other hand, this is an outrage that has been upheld by courts in other states. And so the question was whether or not the school was on notice that it couldn't do this.
Is this the Supreme Court's first look at rights of search and seizure for middle school students and the state's interest in maintaining order in a school setting?
No, this has been a very, very long train of cases. The most relevant one with respect to public schools and kids and students has been this case called New Jersey versus TLO. And in New Jersey versus TLO, which is a 1985 case, what the Supreme Court said was reasonable suspicion means that you have to have some suspicion at the outset before you begin your search, and then the scope of your search has to be reasonable.
In general, the political sense about these cases, and, you know, watching cable television is perhaps not the best way of, you know, sort of sensing what the prevailing mood of Americans is. But I think there's a sense that, hey, these schools need to be tough to crack down on troublemakers, that sort of thing. How does that get translated into the doctrine of law here and protecting the rights of, in this case, a plaintiff who seems to have a pretty good case?
That's a great question. I think that the way in which the thumb on the scale gets put on for the school is through this reasonableness standard, which is A, contextual in nature, and B, it's kind of a term of art in the law for, you know, a very, very low level of review. So this is something less than, say, probable cause, which would be a much more stringent level of review that the school would have to pass.
Now, if they thought she was carrying a knife or a gun, maybe I could see, but ibuprofen?
Yeah, this is just completely outrageous. Essentially, what she's taking is 400, or what she was accused of having. They did not actually find this on her, was a 400 milligram tablet of ibuprofen, which a friend said that she had gotten from her. And so they were looking for more of it on her body. This is two Advils put together. I mean, so this is not something like ecstasy or, you know, any other kind of substance. But, you know, in the school's defense, the year before, you know, they had had this near fatal accident for a kid who had brought drugs into the school. And also the school officials are not pharmacologists, so they can't sort of look at a pill and say, we know exactly what that is.
Right. And, you know, if students were drinking also in combination with other substances, it could be fatal. So you can see what the state, the school's interest might be here. Let's move on to the affirmative action case. And then I want to get into this interesting sort of Eric Holder and the court Department of Justice story.
Absolutely. So in Ricci versus DeStefano, which, as you said, is going to be argued tomorrow, what we have is some white and one Latino firefighter filing a reverse discrimination case saying they were discriminated against because they were not African Americans. And what the city of New Haven is saying in response is saying, look, what we had here was a test, a written multiple choice or written test, I should say. And what we discovered with the test was that it weeded out a vast number of African Americans. So, in fact, no African American would have been eligible for a promotion after this test.
Now, it's not as though that intent is in the test. Statistically, that's a consequence of the test, and it's noted after the fact. That's sort of the issue here, right?
That's exactly the issue, which is to say what the city is saying is this is a facially neutral test with a grossly disproportionate impact in a protected group, namely African Americans. So we believe that this test is flawed. Now, I want to underscore here that under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is federal law governing employment, if a test has a disparate impact, as it's known, on a protected group, the employer can only justify that if it's business related. And so if it has a business justification, so it has to be related to a business necessity. And so in this case, what we're trying to figure out is whether or not this test, whether or not the decision not to use the test
right.
was simply an attempt to comply with that federal anti-discrimination law of saying, this is a discriminatory test, we don't want to use it, is what the city is saying. And the only reason we decided not to certify the results of that test is because we wanted to be in compliance with Title VII.
Whereas, so the plaintiffs are saying, hey, the test was fine. If it had been there, I would be a firefighter. What did you do this for?
Exactly right. And again, the stories are heartbreaking because one of these firefighters who was a white firefighter was dyslexic and he paid, you know, $1,000 to get this on audio tapes and he was studying. Another firefighter was in the hospital room when his child was being delivered studying away. And so they're very sympathetic plaintiffs in mm-hmm. this case. And what they're saying is that the city is actually engaged in pretext. So they're pretending that, oh, we just want to comply with federal law. But what they're actually doing is saying we want to engage in racial balancing and want to discriminate against whites.
All right. So let's take a look at the federal role here. The Justice Department has actually filed a friend of the court briefs in both of these cases, and they are by no means required to do so. This is plaintiffs versus defendants, and the court is sort of weighing in the middle. What do we see in these two friend of the court briefs as far as it you know, suggests a style of Eric Holder, the new attorney general, and even more broadly, Barack Obama, who, as we know, Kenji, is a law professor, or was once a law professor before he got this card gig.
But we're not holding that against him, right, John?
Right, right. We're not. Absolutely not. Well, maybe we should. I don't know what you're going to say.
We should, but we're not. Well, what I'd like to say here is that I was sort of looking at these Solicitor General briefs, and what was really struck me about both of the briefs, which, as you say, were filed for the United States government, and as you also said, the United States government doesn't have to come in
right.
file of this friend of the court brief. What struck me as being common to both of them in both of these cases is that there's a real Obama-esque attempt to give each side its due.
To find a middle ground.
To find the middle ground, to find the common ground, but not in a kind of appeasement, kind of, oh, we're going to, you know, waffle here. It really is a very wise, sensible, intelligent reading of the law. And in both cases, they kind of split the difference. So let me go into specifics just because I think it's useful to talk more concretely. In the Safford case, the strip search case, what they said is this going forward is unacceptable. You cannot do it. On these facts, you cannot strip search a 13-year-old girl.
That's what the government says.
That's what the government says. But we are not going to hold this particular school district liable because we have these other cases in Kansas, for example, and other states where
Declaring it unacceptable to strip search, but backing away from punitive actions against
that
the state
particular
authorities.
School. Yeah,
see.
Exactly. But going forward, like if Safford School District does this again tomorrow, then they're liable because now the law is clear, right? So essentially what the Obama administration is saying, let's forget the past, you know, let's make the law clear going forward, and then, you know, you have to abide by the law and so do all other schools. So that's their recommendation.
Very quickly,
court.
Quickly, what's the sense on affirmative action coming from the Holder Justice Department? And then I have a final question.
On the affirmative action thing, what the United States is saying is, look, this is not a legal question. This is a factual question. One side is saying that it didn't discriminate. It was just trying to comply with federal law. The other side is saying that was just a pretext for discrimination. Whether or not the city of New Haven is telling the truth is a factual question.
Uh-huh.
That's not a legal question. So send it back. They
send
say
it
send it back to the jury.
Interesting. How influential is the Justice Department in bringing cases to the Supreme Court, in deciding what the Supreme Court actually gets to hear because it's so important in actually determining what cases actually make it to the Supreme Court?
As a formal matter, it is not in the sense that the ultimate decision rests with the justices themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is that nobody has an appeal of right to the Supreme Court, which is to say that if I'm appealing from district court to appellate court, I have a right to be heard. If I'm appealing from the federal appellate court to the United States Supreme Court, I have to file a petition to be heard, and only a tiny percentage of those, less than 4%, are heard every year.
So they don't get to the front of the line, but the decisions, particularly if the government is involved, are often some of the weightier issues. issues, even though, you know, sometimes they're not as well.
Exactly right.
Well, interesting stuff, and a great way of thinking about the cases independent of just the facts in the case. Two important cases being argued this week, helping us to explain them and put them in context. Kenji Yoshino, who is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU Law School. Thanks so much for coming down.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.